In closing the meeting, we can say good morning.
Good morning.
James Sterling Young, who won the Bancroft Prize for his great book, The Washington Community, has been the director of our presidency research program and of the Carter Oral History Project, which is one of the jewels, I think, in the Miller Center program. He will introduce Mrs. Carter.
Thank you. I was trying to be very brief here because we have been waiting, and I'm sure Mrs. Carter is eager to begin also. Historians of the next century looking back on our time will notice something few of us noticed, I think, at the time. And this is the transformation of the presidential spouse from a familial role into a role of very considerable public and political responsibility. Historians will no doubt look back to the time of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt to see the beginning of this transition. Many will want to date it its further development as the First Lady becomes a public figure from Jacqueline and John Kennedy's time, but there's no doubt whatever that historians of the next century looking back on this time will regard the First Ladyship of the 39th presidency, Jimmy Carter's presidency, as an extremely important chapter in that development, and will study it accordingly. Not just because of who she is, but because of where she was in history. We're very honored to have you here.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank you for waiting for me. I thought I might get here and have my audience gone. But I got up at 4:30, got to the airport at 10 minutes after 6, and flew to Raleigh and sat in the airplane for an hour and a half. And so that's why I was late this morning. There was nothing I could do about it. And I really thank you for waiting for me. I didn't prepare any formal remarks for this morning. I did, when looking at the directory of my computer, find something that said First Lady, so I looked it up. And it was the answers to some questions that I had received from a student. I had written the answers to the questions about being a First Lady. So I thought I would go over this with you and then answer the questions. The first answer, I don't have the questions, but they're pretty, there's only one that I couldn't determine what the question was. I played many roles as First Lady of the United States, that of wife and confidant of my husband, mother, hostess, and almost full-time volunteer. I had projects that were important to me and found the position one of influence in working on these projects. A First Lady can influence the decision of her husband and other high-ranking government officials on certain issues. If, for instance, she selects a project to work on, it gives the issue visibility and creates interest in government circles. She also has more contact with people. It's easier for a First Lady to get out and talk with people and find out how they feel than it is for a president. The First Lady has entourage enough, but the president, there's no possible way for people to really express their views to him. In fact, sometimes people are so awed by meeting a president, no matter which president it is, they forget the questions that they want to ask him, or forget what they want to find out for them. I only had that happen to me once. When Deng Xiaoping was coming, and we did some research on him and China, and found out that the camellia in our country came from China. And so I called a friend in Moultrie, Georgia. In that community, they have a camellia festival, and asked him to save camellias, and we would decorate the White House with camellias. And so he did. And this has been a friend of mine for a long time. He came in the White House. I met him in the diplomatic room. And I said, "Hello, Mr. Mayor." And he couldn't say one word. And he really tried. I felt so sorry for him. I started talking to him, and he just handed me the camellias. Well, some of them. But then when he came back in the afternoon to decorate, he was fine. We had a nice conversation. But it happens really often with the president. My major objectives as First Lady were to promote acceptance of and better care for the mentally ill and to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. I hope I had some impact on the first. I failed on the second. But we did do what we could do at the federal level. We got the extension for the Equal Rights Amendment passed. I also worked with volunteerism and with problems of the elderly. I was not granted a specific sum of money for my projects. I had a staff at the White House to assist me with all White House entertaining and events, correspondence, press secretary, and so forth, which included one project secretary, and she had one assistant. For all of the things that I did, I had to depend on volunteers because I had so many things going on. I was also provided transportation by the government for all of my activities. The so-called chores were not unpleasant ones. Social events filled the calendar. There were groups to meet to greet daily, meetings with staff to plan events, meals, entertainment, activities for visiting dignitaries, events related to my projects. Correspondence was voluminous and time-consuming, particularly autographing photographs, postcards, programs, newspaper clippings, quilt squares, and whatever was sent to me to autograph. If a president and first lady, oh, this is the one I didn't know the answer to, I mean, didn't know the question. If a president and first lady have a close relationship, criticisms and advice will be accepted in good nature. As in all close relationships between husband and wife, criticisms and advice are sometimes taken and sometimes not. When we were in the White House, Jimmy had been in politics for a long time. I had had the experience of being First Lady of Georgia, which was really very helpful to me by the time I got to the White House. But I had learned when Jimmy was in the State Senate that you're going to be criticized no matter what you do. If you stay in the White House in poor tea, you'll be criticized because you don't get out. If you get out, you'll be criticized because you're not, maybe you're doing too much or something. But anyway, I just had learned, even before I got to the White House, to do what I thought was important because the criticisms are going to come. And that's what I tried to do. I think to be able to do that, you have to be very secure in your beliefs and know what you want to do and know what you stand for and what you want to accomplish and to believe that you're doing the right thing. And then the criticisms do just roll off. You get so used to them. And I also have found local politics the hardest because you know everybody. And you know everybody that supports you, and you know those who say bad things about you. And you feel like everybody at home ought to be for you. And then when it gets on the state and national level, it's much easier because you know that everybody's not going to support you. Eleanor Roosevelt was my favorite First Lady because of her activism and genuine concern for the less fortunate. And Lady Bird Johnson was a special friend of mine. She had come to Georgia when Jimmy was governor and helped me start a roadside beautification program. I had been to the ranch and visited her. And so she's very special to me, too, and still is. I'm glad that I had the chance to be First Lady. I enjoyed the experience, particularly the access to people and leaders in our country and all over the world. But the thing I enjoyed most of all was the ability that comes with the position to focus attention on problems that were of importance to me. If I had a chance to change anything about the role of First Lady, I think it would be to provide her with staff large enough to pursue her projects. Contrary to belief, I had a very small staff. They were competent and dedicated and much overworked. The lights burn late in my offices every night. I'm not sure my influence on the president ever made a difference in his decisions. I always told him what I thought, and he always listened to me. He didn't always react the way I wanted him to. An additional note, since we left the White House, Jim and I have found that we still have the resources to work on any project, undertake any interest that we have. Because Jimmy was present, we can call on experts in almost any field, and they will help. It puts a big responsibility on us, and we're still facing the question that has been part of our lives for a long time. Are we using the influence we have to make life better for people, for all our people? Well, those are just some comments. And this past February of last year, we had a conference at the Carter Center on women in the Constitution, and as part of the bicentennial. And Lady Bird and Betty Ford and Pat Nixon all agreed to co-convene that with me. And we went to the LBJ Ranch, Betty Ford and I, and spent a couple of days with Mrs. Johnson in the planning. And it was really wonderful to be with them, because if I ever see them, it's in receiving lines, and we all go to some place where a speech is being made. It was the first time we had ever had just to sit and talk about the things we're doing now and the things that we had done in the past. We sat on the front porch at the LBJ Ranch for 2 days. Well, not all the time for 2 days, but talked about common problem, common concerns. What do you do, for instance, about accepting the honorary chairmanship or chairpersonship of an organization that you might be interested in, but you don't not going to be able to work with or help? And how do you just lend your name? How did they handle those kinds of situations? How do you handle your mail and so forth? We all agreed that the position of First Lady was one that we liked and enjoyed. And we also all agreed that the position of former First Lady is exciting also. Well, I'd be happy to answer your question.
May I ask if our own First Lady would like to ask the first question?
Do you have an opinion, Mrs. Carter, on whether there should be a salary for First Ladies or for women, spouses in the diplomatic corps or other places throughout government where the wife is often called on to play a big role?
Well, I have never thought about other diplomatic roles particularly, but I've had that question a lot, and as much of a feminist as I am, I've always said that I was glad I didn't have a salary, because if you have a salary, then there will the position will become institutionalized, and there will be duties that you have to perform. I was glad that I could do what I wanted to do. The White House will run without a spouse. The cooks have been in the kitchen. The one that was the major chef was there. I think Lady Bird Johnson hired him. He retired a year or two ago. But the staff at the White House stays on. Presidents come and go. The staff stays on. Those who are indiscreet are not kept very long. If somebody is hiding and they're indiscreet. And you have a social secretary who can plan all of the events. You have enough staff in that capacity in the mansion. We call the middle part of the White House the mansion. The maids and the cooks and so forth. The kitchen has done steak dinners forever. There was not much I could teach them about steak dinners. I had to do that at the governor's office, because we had only prisoners for help, and the First Lady preceding me had not done any entertaining. When I went to see her after Jim was elected, I asked her, this was the wife of the governor of Georgia before Jim, I asked her who helped her with entertaining, and she said, I do it myself. And I said, well, who does the cooking? She said, I do. I said, well, who does waiting on the table? She says, I do. Everything I asked, I went home and asked Jimmy, what have we done? So we had, my secretary and I had to train the prisoners who were the help. And it was really frustrating. I remember one day we had the press, and we had in the basement, and we had the sandwiches and buns, submarine sandwiches or whatever you call them. And I went down just before they came, and they had trimmed the crust off of all the bread. So when I got to the White House, all of that was done for me. I felt free. I didn't have to worry about keeping. It's good that you do have that staff, because there are so many duties that I don't know what you'd do if you had to worry like I did at the governor's mansion. I finally got it running, but it was also new to me. I have told people often that it was a bigger jump from Plains, Georgia to the governor's mansion than it was from the governor's mansion to the White House. Nobody has believed it, but it's absolutely true. The things you do in the White House, where you have state dinners and entertain heads of state and so forth, in the governor's mansion you entertain ambassadors. In the White House you entertain the Congress, and the governor's mansion you entertain the legislature. So we have a lot of the same responsibilities. So being in the governor's mansion was a great help to me by the time I got to the White House.
Other questions?
I would like to encourage others to ask because I'm going to have a chance later.
Would you like to speak about the effect on the children who grow up in the White House?
Well, we are a very close family, and we had always worked together on all and everything. When we were, Jimmy had gotten out of the Navy, and we came home when our oldest son was in the first grade. So we spent all their growing up life, three little boys. And then Amy, our oldest son was 20. Our boys were 20, 17, and 15 when Amy was born. She's almost another generation. But we all went to the White House. It got to the point, it got to where after we were home for about a year, I started going down to the office to help Jimmy. We had an agricultural supply business. I went down first just to answer the telephone for him so he could get out and meet the farmers. His father had died, and he had gotten out of the Navy to go home, and this is his father's business. It was a small business. And then I started cleaning up some while I answered the telephone, and then I started entering the tickets for the farmers when they bought something while Jimmy was going to work into a full-time position. And the little boys would come from school to the peanut warehouse, and we always had something for them to do. And so they felt like they were part of the business. And then when Jimmy ran for the state senate, we didn't campaign very much then. We did some, but it was a very quick election because they had reapportioned the senate and to go by one man, one rule vote. We'd had the unit system in our state. But then when he ran for governor, of course, the whole family got out and worked, all the boys, in 1966. Amy was not born until the next year, 1967. We all felt like we had done that together. And so then when Jimmy was elected governor, we got to the governor's mansion. It was the first time our family had been together for a long time because for 2 years we'd been campaigning in all different directions. And so it was wonderful to have that, to be all together at home. And we lived on the second floor of the governor's mansion. So then we all campaigned for president, and we had the same situation except that all of our children didn't live in the White House, but we all felt that Jimmy could not have done it if we hadn't helped him. And so it kind of drew us together as a family. And then when you're in the White House, or in the governor's mansion, well, more in the White House than the governor's mansion, when the members of the family go out, they're all in the same situation. People want to look at you, to shake hands, for you to sign autographs, to take photographs. And so we treasured those times when we could just be upstairs, the second and third floor of the White House, and be normal people, because that's what we were. But it's very hard to lead a normal life. You don't have some place you can go. And I didn't want my office on the second or third floors of the White House because, and that had been a general rule, I think, because I wanted it just to be home so that I didn't have to dress to go out of the bedroom and the children could bring their friends and it would just be home. And so that's the way it was. My office was in the East Wing. Jimmy's is in the West Wing, of course. First Lady's staff is in the East Wing. And so I think this doesn't happen to all families, but I think politics drew our family together. I have known wives when Jimmy was in the state senate, for instance, who never, never could participate, didn't like it at all. Families were torn, and but ours was never that way, and I think it was because we had all felt a part of the process. It's hard. It was harder for Amy. Well, it was not hard for Amy while we were there. It was harder for her to leave Washington than it was for the others because she was 13 and all her friends were there. But she really, really was torn when she had to leave all of her friends. That was the main thing. I think Amy grew out of it, came through the experience with a good perspective, I think. Amy knew nothing but political life until we came home from the White House. I remember sitting in my office at the governor's mansion, which was on the second floor where we lived, but it was right at this one corner where the family did not have to go. But I was working in there one day, and she came in. It was a Saturday, and her father was going to take her to the zoo. She was 3 years old, and she wanted a pencil that would fit in her pocketbook. And I said, Amy, what do you want a pencil for? She said, to sign autographs. Well, the first time I signed an autograph, I was overwhelmed. And then when one day somebody asked her how it felt to live in the White House, she said, natural. Well, we moved to the governor's mansion right after her third birthday. It has an 18-acre lot with a fence around it. I think the White House has 18 and a half acres with a fence around it. We lived on the second floor with the tourists downstairs every day. White House, we lived on the second floor with the tourists downstairs. And so it was natural for us. And I think the only one of our children who was really distressed was Jeffrey, our youngest son, who was probably 16, I'm not sure when he was the youngest son when Jim was elected governor. And he really was distressed at school because he was at that age, the two other boys were old enough to be a little bit secure, but he didn't ever know whether people liked him because he was the governor's son or because he was Jeffrey. It really distressed him. And he had a tough time accommodating. He was the first year of college. He went out to Seattle and worked on a barge for a year while Jimmy was governor, just to get away from people knowing him. He said so he could have some real friends that he knew liked him because he was Jeffrey. So he was the one that was hurt the most, I think.
Next question, Henry Theobart.
Becoming associated with the spouses of various heads of state, was it possible to get beyond a purely formal relationship with them?
Yes, it was. And that was one of the more interesting things to me. I really enjoyed getting to know people like Mrs. Jim Callahan, and Jim Callahan was Prime Minister in Great Britain, his wife, Jehan Sadat, and other people. When we first got to the White House, before we had the first state dinner, we looked at these film of state visits, before we had this first state visit of the past, where you go out on the South Lawn of the White House and you greet the head of state and his wife, and he makes an address, and the president, Jimmy, would welcome him, and then he would respond. And but then we would go inside. But what I started to say was we really worked on that to get it just right, and I had it drilled into me that I was supposed to keep the other first lady on my right. That was the side of was the highest position in office. We got we went inside to the receiving line, and this was the White House, this was the Army that directed this. It was White House social aides who had been drilled in this, and they put the first lady on my left. Mm-hmm. And it was Jimmy, and Jimmy had the president, and I kept whispering, oh, this one social aide said, Mrs. Carter, it's all right, this is a left-hand receiving line. Well, I thought I had been so just very nervous about protocol, whether I was going to do everything right or not, and after that I decided the protocol is just being friendly. Southern hospitality is protocol. And when you relax with these first ladies, they're just really human beings, and they were wonderful. Some warm, and you learn a lot from them. And we became really close friends. Jehan Sadat is one of my very close friends, and she has been to planes to see us, and we visit together pretty often when we go to Egypt. She teaches in the United States now. She has been since the first year after Sadat died. She had a tough time over there because after he died, he was not very important in the eyes of the government that succeeded him. And she had a tough time, but she had to stay in mourning for a year, and then she left. And she didn't start going back until last summer for more than just October, when President Sadat died. She'd go and they'd have a little memorial service, and she'd see her family. Sometimes they would visit her in the United States, but now they're accepting her back into society, and she's staying over there more and more. But you do get to be friends with them. One time, Jim Callahan and Audrey were visiting their daughter who lived in Washington, and from England. And they came to see us in the afternoon just to call. We sat out on the Truman balcony and talked, and they kept saying, it got to be dinner time. And so Mary, the maid, all the staff was gone because it was a Saturday. One thing I never could get used to was I had cooked for 25 years. We'd been married 25 years when Jimmy was elected governor, and I had always done all the cooking. And we got to the governor's mansion, and I had to direct the staff, but I got so distressed because I just got to where I hungered to be in the kitchen, and then I'd go in to cook something, the pots were this big. We cooked for 25 every day. So Mary was one of the prisoners. She was a trustee. She was not guilty of the crime she was in prison for, but being black and 17 years old when she was charged with murder, she saw her attorney for the first time in the courtroom, her assigned lawyer. He told her to plead guilty and he'd get her off life. She pled guilty and got life, and was totally innocent. But she was Amy's maid she stayed with Amy in the governor's mansion, but she could do anything. She could entertain guests, she could cook, she could do anything. And so one Saturday, Mary had wanted to cook dinner. So every Saturday we let the staff go so that we could have Saturday night and Sunday. They would come in for lunch on Sunday and then leave, which is the first time they'd ever been able to do that. They were delighted. So on that Saturday, Mary had cooked dinner. She had cooked ham, country cured ham, collard greens, baked sweet potatoes, cornbread. It was just a real southern meal. And so finally I said, Jimmy, I whispered to him that we have to invite him for dinner because they just weren't leaving. So we invited them for dinner. And they loved it. But you do get to be close with people.
Next question. Yes, Doris Franz.
Do I remember correctly that you sat in on cabinet meetings, and was that at your request, your husband's request, and what is your feeling about that?
I cannot imagine anybody being in the White House and being asked to sit in the cabinet meetings and not doing it. We had been there for over a year. It was in February of 78 when I started going to cabinet meetings. And the reason that I went, that Jimmy asked me to come, was because there is almost no way to get a true picture of what's happening by the news. If they have a minute and a half on television for something, or the newspaper has just a small write-up. The issues are so complicated, particularly the issues that come to the president's or the governor's desk, because if they were easy, they could have been solved somewhere else down the line. So they're the most difficult issues. And every day when Jim got off the elevator, I was there to say, why did you do this? What's happening about this? And so forth. So finally, I think in exasperation, he said, why don't you come to the cabinet meetings? And then you'll know why we make these decisions. But what people don't understand about cabinet meetings is that the cabinet sits around a table. They have chairs, their names on the chairs, and nobody but the cabinet sits in those chairs. Around the wall, just exactly like this, are a lot of other people, secretaries, people that cabinet officers have asked to come in to report on some project or problem or issue. Lesser government officials than cabinet level, because I would come in the door and sit by Max Cleland, who was the head of the Veterans Administration, and he was in a wheelchair, and he always stood by the door. So I went every Tuesday. That year, Jim was having cabinet meetings every week. I think they got less before he left office, but I would go and sit as much as I could. I took notes. And sometimes if I didn't understand something when Jimmy got home, I would ask him about it. But I thought it was important for me to know generally what was going on. I never knew details. Because I had campaigned all over the country telling people that my husband was going to do this. And then when I went out, I had press conferences and they would ask me what he was doing. I needed to know. I got briefings on Latin America from the National Security Advisor for Latin America monthly. I got briefings from the assistant to the president for problems of the elderly regularly. I got briefings from the on women's issues. And then every month, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was national security advisor, would brief all of the staff in the movie theater at the White House on the relationship between our country and different countries in the world and what problems are going on there. And then to be able to sit in staff meetings, I had a general idea of what was going on. And it was really helpful. And for my own satisfaction to know what Jimmy was doing and why he was doing things, but also so that I could tell people when I went out.
Next question.
I got a lot of criticism for it, but I would do it over again, and I would do it sooner next time.
Carol Jackson.
Would you care to comment on your experiences with the Habitat housing program?
Habitat for Humanity is a program that we've been involved in since we got home. The international headquarters is in Americus, Georgia, which is our county seat, 10 miles from Plains. And that's how we got involved with it, because people come from all over the world, really, for orientation in Americus, Georgia, learn how to go back home and start a Habitat project. Habitat is a program that builds houses, let's see, a decent home and a decent community for God's people in need, building homes for the poor. And it's not a giveaway program. People that have the houses, get the houses, have to pay for them. They pay cost. We don't charge any interest. The Bible says if you lend a poor man money, you don't charge any interest. And so Miller Fuller, who founded Habitat, says we go by the economics of the Bible. And the price is not minimal, but comparatively speaking, it is, because most all of the labor is donated, and many of the supplies for the houses. People donate wall board, and one day I went in a house in Charlotte, North Carolina, that had a yellow commode and a turquoise sink. And they had painted it room so that it looked fine, but some... the company had some spare, I guess, bathroom fixtures that had given them to Habitat. And so we charged them cost and no interest and give them 25 years to pay. And that way they are able to afford a house when they never would ever be able to otherwise. When we got home, there were about 40 programs in about 40 cities in the United States. Now we have, the last count was 326 communities in the United States and 26 countries with 70-something programs overseas. So it has just exploded. It's one of the most wonderful programs that I've ever been involved in. And Habitat does not go out and ask people to start a program. People come to Habitat and or hear about it and inquire about it and come to Americus for orientation. And they teach them how to organize a program. We get a lot more credit for that than we deserve, because we work one week on a work camp. But it's been highly visible. So of all the things we're doing now, that's the one thing people know about. But Jimmy has been on the board. I've been on the board of advisors. Generally, if I'm making a speech in the community, I will see if there's a Habitat project there and visit it, because we always need volunteers and we always need money. It's a wonderful program.
Any questions in the outer reaches? Any questions around the table? Yes?
I did stretch back that fall, and Mrs. Roosevelt was one of the
husband, especially him, especially wife, and I admired that much. And her career stretched on so long after her husband passed. I think because of the deep interest she entered into when she was in the White House. Did you have experiences that you feel create a desire on your part to introduce new and leadership-oriented ways for women in our society?
I did. I am involved with women's issues now. We have the Carter Center in Atlanta. The Carter Presidential Center, the Presidential Library is there, and across we have two lakes that are joined by 19 feet of waterfall. It's really beautiful. And the libraries ran across the lakes are three round buildings, pods we call them. The first one is the Carter Center of Emory University. It's a school of Emory, like the law school, the med school. And we have nine fellows who teach at Emory too, but they are Carter fellows and they work around the year-round in that area. We have Middle East, peace in the Middle East, U.S.-Soviet relations, arms control, democracy in the Latin Americas, human rights, conflict resolution, a heavy emphasis on health because our executive director is Bill Fagey, who was the head of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta for 10 years, I think, before he came to be our executive director. He has the reputation of being the leading expert in the world on preventive health care. We have one on African studies, but we have the fellows, and we do this scholarly work at the Carter Center of Emory. Then the next pod is one that we have programs which try to put into action what we learn from the studies. We don't want just to be another study center that studies and just puts the studies on a shelf. And as a result of that, we have agricultural programs teaching farmers to increase their food production in many African countries and some Asian countries, Bangladesh, for instance. We have health programs in many countries. We have two philanthropists who finance these programs overseas. One man has banks in 72 countries in the world, and he puts a certain portion of his profits back into the countries, at least 10%. And one in his home country of Pakistan, he puts 100% of the profits from his bank back into that country. And so he has the funds, and we have the expertise. We can, because Jim was president, we can call on anybody to help us with our program and the experts. And we only send two or three people into a country. And Jimmy signs a contract with the head of state. They have to furnish the personnel. They have to agree, for instance, in the agricultural programs to let the farmers sell their produce at or about market price. Otherwise, they've not been able to sell anything they made at a profit. So they just grow enough food grain to support their families. But there's no incentive to do it. So that's a big step forward for some of these socialist countries. But anyway, we have all of those programs. And my main interest in the White House was in mental health. And I have a grant from Gannett Foundation, which is I'm on the Gannett board. Gannett Communications Corporation is USA Today and over 100 newspapers and some television stations and so forth. And I have a grant from the foundation to do a study every year on some mental health issues, so I've kept that alive. And the college in my home county has started the Rosalind Carter Institute for Human Development. And I'm working there. We're now getting together all the caregivers in our whole surrounding area and bringing them together to help them with their problems. And the first one was several years ago. It's so exciting to see them because there's such burnout, as they call it, with people who care for others all the time. You never see, very seldom around people who smile and are happy. And so that's been a real, we're trying to start a model because there's no program like this in the United States now. So I've kept those alive. Last year we had a conference on women in the Constitution, and we studied the influence of women on the Constitution from the early days to now, and the impact of the Constitution on women. And it's really, really thrilling. And now we're doing, developing a secondary school curriculum about these women that we learned about. We want to get them in history books. I'm a distinguished lecturer at Agnes Scott College in Atlanta, and we're having a symposium the next 2 days, tomorrow and the next day, on the transmission of values to women, which has really been exciting. I've been writing, I have to give a personal perspective on the transmission of values to women. Talking about my mother, my grandmother, and then how things had changed by the time I got to Amy, and what's in the future. And another one on women in politics. So I'm busy. And we travel so much with our programs in these African and Asian countries. We have a program in China. Mr. Abadie has a bank in China, has banks. And he wanted to do something there. And Deng Xiaoping wanted Jimmy to help teach them how to care for handicapped people. And so we are developing now we've already teaching teachers in China who work with special education classes, children in special education classes. And tomorrow night or the next night, we are having AT&T has developed this process where we can have teachers at the Carter Center through some way, through satellite, of course, to teach the teachers in China. We already have, a few people there, but then we're going to see the first program tomorrow night before I'm going to be in Atlanta for the next 2 days. But Deng Xiaoping's son was thrown out of the window during the Cultural Revolution. He's been in a wheelchair all of his life. And in China, when somebody lost a leg or arm, they were kind of outcast. Either they were taken care of by the family, but nobody really paid any attention to it. And we found a man, we learned in pursuing this, that there was a man in Atlanta who lost a leg in the Civil War, and he came back to Atlanta and whittled one for himself. And then he whittled some for friends and finally developed a battery, a process to do them on a large scale. It's one of the largest. It's not factory because there's several of them, and they're all in the South. One of the largest businesses for manufacturing prostheses in the United States. So we sent him over to China. As I say, we only send two or three people into these countries. So now they're building these factories that can produce the latest in prostheses. It's really exciting. We're doing legs and arms, and I had not thought about anything else. So I went to visit that one of the plants in China. And this little girl, just tiny little girl, she must not have been over 4 or 5 years old, was clinging to her mother's skirt, and she had this sad look on her face, and she had lost an eye. Mother said she had a tumor and had to have it removed. And so I toured the building. I came back down to the second floor, and this little girl was sitting there with a mirror, and she had an artificial eye put in, and she had a grin from here to here. That makes you feel so good. She was just a totally changed child by the time I got from the top of the building back then. But it's really interesting and exciting work. We also started that same program in Kenya. President Moi in Kenya found out about the China program and wanted us to start one in his country. We have learned, and I'm taking some medicine for sinus, which makes me very dry. I'm sorry about this. We learned that what I started to say was that in all of these third world countries, there is a network of agricultural workers who have been, and also health workers, that agricultural workers have been sent to the international experiment stations by foundations, by our country, by European countries. And when and they learn, supposed to learn how to go back home and teach the farmers how to improve their crops, they go back home and there's no program for them in the government, no way for them to teach what they've learned. Some of them are teaching in schools and some working in drug stores or other places. The network of health people have been to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. We have Dr. Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for the Green Revolution in India, oversees all of our agriculture programs, and Dr. Fagy from the Centers for Disease Control, who for the 10 years before he came just had trained people from these other countries who come for 6 weeks, I think, and learn how to go back home. They're supposed to be learning 6 weeks. He said it was always frustrating to them because when they get back home, they're supposed to know how to take care of everybody's medical problem. So we ask for those people who have been either to the Centers for Disease Control for health programs or to the experiment stations. We not only ask for them, we get the records and see who made the best grades in their studies in these places and did the best work. And we ask for them, and without exception, the heads of state will give them to us.